Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. It's my pleasure to have as our guest today one of the leading activists and writers on communication policy issues, not only in the United States today, but for the past generation. He's also the author of a terrific brand new book on new media and the future of democracy. His name is Jeff Chester. The book is Digital Destiny. So you're going to have a wonderful hour today listening to Jeff Chester talk about the book and media politics today. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The United States Army surrenders in its attempt to haul independent journalist Sarah Olson into the court-martial of an officer who objected to deployment in Iraq. Olson had been facing a subpoena to substantiate her scoop interview with Lieutenant Aaron Watada, but just a week before his trial, the Army dismissed the charges against Watada that were based upon his quotes in her stories. Olson says she's happy to be out of the Army's sights, but happier still about upholding the principles of her defense.
It's really about journalists to gather up and disseminate news without governments telling them who they can and can't talk to. It's also about individuals, particularly members of the military, being able to express personal beliefs.
The Army's capitulation came just weeks after the launch of Defend the Press, a coalition of notable journalists, authors, scholars, and thousands of concerned citizens, which put pressure on the Army to reconsider its plans to force a journalist to testify in what is essentially a case determining the limits of free speech for soldiers. Lieutenant Watada himself still faces up to 2 years in prison for speaking out publicly, though not in uniform, against the war. Olson's case is just one of several involving government harassment of independent media.
The government in the United States is handing out more and more subpoenas, I think, you know, in some very clear ways, kind of trying to control the dissemination of information. It's a kind of a slippery slope once you get the government involved in your press.
There are those who've suffered more than Olson. One of them is videographer Josh Wolf, now going into his fifth month of imprisonment for refusing to hand over unpublished video of a 2005 demonstration in San Francisco.
On February 6th, he will become the longest jailed journalist in U.S. history where the crime is not complying with a subpoena.
To learn more about Sarah Olson's near trip to a military tribunal and the freedom of journalists to report in a time of war, visit www.defendthepress.org. For more about the case of Josh Wolf, see www.joshwolf.net.
Of the 10 studies the FCC has commissioned as part of its media ownership rules review, none of them propose to examine the diversity of local media markets in any meaningful way. But a working group headed by the Center for American Progress seeks to change that. They've developed a proposal by which the FCC might measure local media diversity, looking at factors like how many independent outlets for news and public affairs information are available in a given market, what their primary platforms are, potential audience, and how many people are employed in the production of local content. Center for American Progress senior fellow Mark Lloyd coordinated the project. He says the FCC could then take these measurements to the next level of analysis. How does local media actually work to inform the public?
We propose tying the numbers of these measurements together to local civic engagement and civic knowledge, such as voting levels, participation in community groups, knowledge of local political and civic information. And in this fashion, the FCC can determine what combination of diversity measures produces the most participation and the most civic knowledge.
It's an ambitious goal. Dr. Phil Napoli, co-author of the Diversity Metrics, says the FCC's already dismantled its ability to collect the information necessary to assess local media diversity by anything other than market values.
The FCC no longer gathers detailed financial data from broadcast licensees. No longer does it gather meaningful data on programming practices, such as the provision of local news and public affairs. The gathering of data on minority and female ownership of media outlets has become increasingly haphazard. The FCC's gathering of employment data has largely been gutted, such that it's very difficult today to get any sense of how employment in these industries is changing over time.
The working group's next goal is to examine the diversity metrics of two test markets, Los Angeles and Madison, Wisconsin. It will build on the work of people like Texas State University professor Federico Subervi, who recently looked for signs of diversity in local radio deep in the heart of Texas and was astounded by what he found.
Not one single radio station in Spanish from Austin to San Antonio and all the counties serving 42% of the population there provides any Spanish language local news. It comes in from Mexico, from Iowa, and from Florida.
The FCC's 10 studies may be complete by as early as this summer, but it could be as long as next year before the agency formally proposes changes to its media ownership regulations.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Beautiful Urbana, Illinois. I'm in Campbell Hall, this lovely building on the campus at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Our guest today is Jeff Chester, the Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy, and without doubt one of the nation's leading advocates working on telecommunications issues. Jeff Chester is a former investigative reporter and filmmaker, and he has been at the forefront of virtually every major media policy fight in the United States for the past two decades. He is the author today that we'll be speaking about. He's author of a brand new book, which I've had the privilege of reading, Digital Destiny, New Media and the Future of Democracy, published in 2007 by New Press. Jeff Chester, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob.
It's really a pleasure to have you here. Jeff, you have a rich and storied personal history, which I think comes through periodically in the book, and it informs your book, and you sometimes, we'll probably talk about it a little bit during the show. But first of all, tell me, why did you decide to write this book, Digital Destiny? What was your motivation? What was the point of the book?
Well, I think the country, indeed the world, is at a very important crossroads. I mean, this very powerful system of digital media is rapidly developing here in the United States and certainly elsewhere. It's going to, in many ways, define our lives. It's going to be a tremendous influence on us personally and in our communities and in our nation. And how we shape this new media system to ensure that it addresses the needs of a democracy, is, I think, the foremost question. And unless we intervene, unless we consciously shape and challenge this powerful new system, I do fear, and indeed it's what the book in a way is about, is that it will do a fabulous job in turning the nation and many other countries in the world into all-consuming societies. I mean, the most powerful application, the most powerful set of technologies that is shaping the U.S. digital media environment is really focused on to serve the needs of advertisers and marketers. It's to create a system of personalized marketing that will further, I fear, focus our attention on buying things and on satisfying personal needs, but not help us address the array of problems that we must address if we're going to have a just society here in the United States. So we're at a crossroads, and I want to sort of once again sound the alarm, much like you have over the years. It's by no means certain that new media, digital technology, will serve the public interest on its own. And as you know better than anyone else, powerful cultural and political forces will shape these technologies. Many people believe that we don't have to worry. We just have to sit back and everything is going to be fine. I don't believe that, and that's why I wrote the book.
Jeff Chester, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Jeff, you know, this is a book that is a dissident opinion in many respects because I think a lot of the conventional wisdom is that, you know, pretty much if you're online, you can go wherever you want to go, do whatever you want to do. It's pretty easy to get a website up. No one's going to force you to look at a dumb ad if you don't want to. No one's going to force you to buy something you don't want to. You can go to YouTube and MySpace and do your own thing. You can email whoever you want. And sure, there might be some spam that comes in, but you'll learn how to get around it. But basically, you know, you control your fate with the internet. It's what you do is your business. And you're saying that's not true. Why is that picture that, you know, with MySpace and YouTube and email and not an accurate picture of the future of the internet?
Well, I think we're at an interesting place now. And for those of your listeners who either remember or have read your books, they might recall that during the early days of radio in the 1930s and the early days of television in the 50s and certainly in the early days of cable television in the 1970s, people had a kind of similar attitude towards the then new media. And indeed, the industry itself predicted that if left on its own, the then new media of the time would in fact fulfill a democratic a function. We didn't have to worry. What I've been doing, along with colleagues, have been tracking the politics of digital media. And by no means the open system we have today will remain the fundamental characteristic of the new media moving forward. It's going to be shaped, as I mentioned, by political and economic forces. It already is in very profound ways. Now, you have, of course, the threat to the internet itself, the network neutrality debate. Now, I and colleagues have been tracking this since the late 1990s, have been yelling and screaming about it, because it's very clear that the big phone and cable companies, and they're really just about a half a dozen, who control 98% of the U.S. high-speed internet market known as broadband, but the big phone and cable giants, they don't want the internet to evolve as a kind of open democratic system. Then you have those companies and the very other powerful companies, including companies like Google and Fox, who want to make sure that they're able to dominate in this new media world as well. So there's a tremendous amount of consolidation. I think invisible to many people is the already significant consolidation going into the new media area. Hundreds of billions of dollars have been spent over the last few years by some of the leading companies to acquire these powerful new media outlets. The best known, of course, would be Rupert Murdoch's News Corp buying MySpace and Google, which is actually working with Murdoch in the MySpace deal, recently buying YouTube. So there's tremendous consolidation. And behind that, and really off the radar screen, and it's at the core of my book and what I was most concerned about, are these powerful technologies backed by the forces of advertising, marketing, and the deepest pockets of the largest and wealthiest global brands. That is what is shaping the technologies and the distribution system and how this new media system evolves. And I am concerned that it's their content, their messages, combined with the power of interactivity and these mass digital persuasion technologies, as they call them, that is going to over time shape this digital media system as it flows to us through the PC, through the TV as it goes digital, and increasingly over this very important mobile system that wherever we go and walk on the street, it will be there. It's going to be shaped by this big money and the needs of the big advertisers and marketers and the big media companies and their allies, and that's what's going to dominate. Because in addition to the powerful money interests, we have a, as you know once again so well, we have a sort of public interest media system in this country in not only in a total crisis, but in a way in a meltdown. So when you add all those up, I would say we should be very concerned about the future of diversity in the digital world, despite all the glories it will provide and despite the openness that we see today.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Jeff Chester, the executive director for the Center for Digital Democracy. What's the website for that, Jeff?
Democraticmedia.org.
democraticmedia.org. I urge people to go to that if you're interested in these issues. And if you're not interested in these issues, you're listening to the wrong show. Jeff Chester is the author of the brand new book, Digital Destiny, New Media and the Future of Democracy, published in 2007, this year by New Press. I had the privilege, Jeff, as you know, of using this book. I was the first person to get it. Literally, they did an early press run to get this off so I could use it in my very large undergraduate class in the fall of 2006, last fall. 300 students read it, and I can say that they were captivated by it. It was very popular. This is a book that does not require a great deal of expertise in the subject. You aren't going to be wonked out with accounting and engineering terms. It's a page-turner. I urge people to take a look at it if you're interested in these issues. Jeff, you know, one of the things you do in this book is you recount a lot of the history that got us to this point in policymaking. You go through cable television, you go through the history of the FCC, you go through the Telecommunications Act of 1996, and talk about how those developed, how they took place, what the implications were, and how that got us to the point we are today. You talk about the great media ownership fight in 2003. All of these things you participated in as an activist in Washington, D.C. Let's start on this subject. With the cable industry, because I know, if I'm not mistaken, you cut your teeth sort of working on cable issues a while back. And I don't think many Americans understand today, especially younger ones, that cable television wasn't born as a monopoly industry with a couple companies owning everything. Can you talk a little bit about the history of cable industry, the debates over it, how it was set up, and how we got to the point we are today with cable television?
I just think that the cable fable, as people call it, both within the industry and the critics, such as you and myself, is so important because when cable emerged as a new technology particularly in the 1960s, the cable industry itself and indeed all the advocates and activists as well said, "Look, this is a technology that's going to democratize video communications in the United States. We're not going to have to be hostage to just three major networks. We're going to have hundreds and hundreds of channels." And the industry, the cable industry itself, said, "Look, we'll provide each community with dozens, if not more, channels. We'll provide, there's an opportunity," the cable industry said, and advocates were hopeful, "there's an opportunity so that women and people of color who don't own any video channels now will be able to own content, will be able to use the power of interactive video, and even computers." All these new technologies were on the drawing boards then, and the cable industry promised to deliver them. "We'll use the power of these new interactive technologies to address community issues, to deal with poverty and to deal with racism." So the sky was the limit. And all you have to do, the company said, was sign on the bottom line cities, and we will provide you with all these wonderful technologies. Of course, what happened was that the minute these contracts were signed, the cable lobby, either in the state legislature or and then eventually nationally in 1984, the cable industry never intended to fulfill those promises, and there were no public policies to secure them. There was no political activism to effectively fight the cable industry. So the cable industry was able to go to first state legislatures, and that's where I first sort of, as you said, cut my teeth in exposing the deregulation that occurred in California in 1982, doing my best to fight it, even though there were so few people at the time doing so. And it was the cable industry's win in California that was the blueprint for what they were able to do 2 years later in 1984.
And, Jeff, before you go on, I just want to repeat a point you made for listeners to understand that what cable companies get is from a municipal government, they get a monopoly license to be the only cable company. They get the rights to tear up land. They're given this tremendous privilege. So the deal was they would do all sorts of things in exchange for having this government create a monopoly with all sorts of privileges attendant to it.
That's true, but even beyond that's true. But the theory was at the time that only one company could do this, and it didn't make sense to have more than one company.
A natural monopoly.
But at the same time, Bob, what I think is also important to consider was that the promise of these technologies wasn't just that, in exchange for being a monopoly, you'll give us X and Y. The cable industry and others said these are technologies that can benefit communities. They were self-described, quote-unquote, community communication systems. And I think as we think about today, what the U.S. desperately needs at a time when local television, broadcast television, doesn't serve the public interest and locally, and neither does most of television, how do we re-envision community communications in the digital era? Because we didn't get it with cable. They bought politicians left and right, Republicans and Democrats, and they were able to break those promises. So today, what we have with American cable is just a shell of what was promised. They built us a fabulous entertainment system, but not one designed to serve Democratic communications. So I would say that even with today's debate, as the phone companies are entering the so-called cable business in communities, and it's no longer a so-called monopoly anymore, the same promise has to be proffered in front of these companies. Will you really serve the communities? And, of course, what the cable and the phone industry ultimately want is not to have to serve communities, but just to be able to reap huge revenues from a captive public.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Jeff Chester, author of the new book Digital Destiny, New Media and the Future of Democracy. We pre-recorded this show shortly before going on air, so please sit back, relax, and let Jeff Chester and yours truly, Bob McChesney, do the yakking today. This book covers a lot of ground leading us up to the present and going forward into the future. We've just been talking about the cable industry, which has certainly emerged as a dominant force in sort of the future of the Internet. Let's talk also an agency you talk a lot about in this book that I think very few Americans know much about, that more do today, say, than 5 or 10 years ago, certainly. But still, it's for such an extraordinarily important agency, it's largely unknown, which is the Federal Communications Commission. Jeff, you know as much about it as just about anyone. Could you talk, just if you were giving an introductory primer on the FCC, what would it be? And then go into some of the material in the book about how it operates in the real world.
Well, look, this is supposed to be an agency that serves the average member of society. It's supposed to be a kind of governmental watchdog over the electronic media industry, radio, broadcasting, cable, and telephone, and satellite. It's supposed to ensure that these companies and these media, in fact, serve, quote, the public interest, convenience, and necessity. But from its very beginning, it has been an agency captured and dominated by the very corporate interests it is supposed to oversee. And, of course, this happens with so many other governmental entities. But if you ask yourself, you know, why don't we have a local media system that better provides us with news and information? Why are my cable bills so high? You know, that you have to ask yourself, well, where is the FCC? And the FCC is simply too busy, staffers at the FCC are simply too busy looking to find their next job with the very industry they are supposed to regulate.
Yeah, you talk about this in the book, Jeff Chester, and you go into some detail. It's quite striking. Could you give some examples of FCC officials who've sort of gone through the sort of golden revolving door?
Every former chair and almost every former commissioner, with, you know, rare exceptions, has gone to work right away for the industry that just, you know, a few months ago they oversaw. You know, Michael Powell, the former Republican chair, the last Republican chair of the FCC, Kevin Martin's predecessor is the current chair. He's working now for a venture capital firm in charge of their media buying business. William Kennard, the Democratic chair predecessor of Mr. Powell, is working for the Carlyle Group, buying telecommunications and media properties. The most powerful media lobbyist in the United States, representing the interests of all the largest media companies, are former chairs of the Federal Communications Commission. This is an agency that, by and large, has been utterly corrupted. It is incapable of defending the average person, the public interest. They have what I'd like to say a kind of staffers are so intimidated about the political positions of the chair that they're afraid to tell them what they really think. So it's an agency that has been corrupted by, as you say, this golden revolving door between industry and the agency. They know that very soon the people that they're supposed to oversee will likely be their employer. How can we expect them to serve us if they know that there's going to be a six-figure and up meal ticket soon ahead?
Now, is the FCC sort of like the Supreme Court, the Congress or the Senate approves like these distinguished people who are vetted and reviewed for their great command of communication issues and their understanding of the importance of communication for democracy? Then they get long distinguished terms where they're highly independent and they have fierce debates over the value of media for democracy amongst themselves and come up with lofty opinions. Is this an accurate way to understand what takes how the FCC operates?
You know, it's the people who get appointed to the commission, for the most part, are, you know, political cronies of the of powerful members of Congress or of the White House. They have generally no communications background. They've come from industry. And will likely know they're going to return from industry. They're dined and wined by the industry itself. They follow and endorse the corporate media line by and large. I mean, as you know well, we just happen to have two extremely very rare commissioners at the Federal Communications Commission at the moment who happen to be Democrats who, for a variety of reasons, stand out as truly independent public servants. And I believe that Congress, and I believe that the industry will make sure that there'll never be people like those two again ever appointed to the Federal Communications Commission. No, I mean, the FCC is a kind of dumping ground in a way for people who have no commitment to serve the public, who see themselves more as helpers to the corporate media agenda.
Well, you know, you've mentioned the two Democrats who have seemed to have strong records as public servants, Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein, both of whom have been guests on Media Matters over the years. Are the issues that we talk about, allocating these monopoly radio and TV licenses, the regulation of broadcasting of satellite and cable television, are these issues that have traditionally broken down at the FCC or even in Washington more broadly on partisan lines? We've got Republicans on one side ostensibly pushing a free market position and Democrats being more sympathetic to a regulatory position on the other side and the sort of fierce battles at that level?
From my perspective, I think that generally on the commission, there's been a kind of uniformity. Regardless of political party, they have generally supported the industry. Now, when there were powerful Democratic Party critics in Congress running the communications committees, then you would have more opposition from Democratic commissioners to such things as big media mergers and price gouging with cable, for example. For consumers, but by and large, I think that both parties are under the control of the industry, and that's why, going back to the theme of my book, I think we have to look very pragmatically at what is going to happen here in terms of public policy and the crisis we have with our communication system, as I'm sure your listeners know well from your show and their other readings. I mean, the newspaper industry is in crisis. Major changes are going on with television. We really need to ensure that over the next few years that the public interest is served. And I'm concerned that it's not going to be addressed by the policymakers because they're going to be so much under the control, even the new Democratic majority, of the powerful telecommunications lobbyists.
Jeff, one of the topics of the book that I found especially interesting that you put a lot of time on is the Telecommunications Act of 1996. It's an act that has been referred to on this program periodically, and I think there's an assumption that probably people know about it since we talk about it, but there's really no reason people would know about it since it got no press coverage. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the importance of the Telecom Act and why you devoted so much time to it in the book, what we learned from it.
Well, the the communications industry wanted to further weaken and eliminate the safeguards, the policy safeguards that had been developed over the decades to help protect the average American. Policies and rules have been created that limited the number of radio and broadcast television stations, for example, that any one company could own, both in a community and nationally. There were rules encouraging, ensuring more diversity of ownership, prohibiting, for example, the same company in your town owning a local television station with your daily newspaper. The big media companies have long wanted to eliminate those safeguards because in their worldview, the more they own, the more they control, the better to fulfill their business objectives, which of course would include laying off a lot of people and doing all kinds of cost cutting. And so they've been trying to rewrite the 1934 Communications Act for a number of years, including the 1970s. And finally, by 1996, especially with the Republican-controlled Congress and with the support of then Speaker Gingrich, they were able to pass this legislation. But I think one of the points I was trying to make in the book is that, look, at the end of the day, it was both President Clinton and the Democrats and the Republicans that jointly worked together to pass this legislation that allowed a handful of companies, such as Clear Channel, to gobble up huge numbers of stations, further consolidating and concentrating our media. It was Republicans and Democrats working together under the sway of the powerful media and telecommunications lobby that did nothing to ensure that the public would have access to the Internet, even though the legislation itself was hailed as helping make the so-called information superhighway more available. It's the corporate media lobby's big bucks and power, along with their Wall Street backers, and the hold they have over both political parties that is at the core of what was corrupt in the 1996 Communications Act, and I fear will continue to be corrupt as these battles over the future of U.S. media go on in this new Congress.
Vice President Al Gore plays a conspicuous role in your book, and you discuss the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Gore, of course, in addition to being an environmentalist, sort of his identity around environmental issues, the other issue that he staked his career on before he became vice president while in the U.S. Senate was as a proponent of the information age. And the joke, of course, was that he invented the Internet, that he said that, which I don't think was true. But nonetheless, he did claim to have a certain affinity for the Internet.
He sponsored some very important early legislation that led ultimately to what is known as the Internet.
So he played a crucial role. So he certainly wasn't pulling out of his private parts to say that. But how does Al Gore, you have an interesting discussion of how Gore's relationship to the industry evolved while as vice president. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, look, Gore, first place, I think to his credit, Gore was a critic of the cable industry during his time as a senator. But when he became part of the Clinton administration, and it does say more about the Clinton administration, but, Gore was one of those people who, at the end of the day, called the Telecommunications Act, which he was involved in negotiating, a huge win for democracy, that the Telecommunications Act of 96 would, in fact, ensure that America would have a more diverse communication system. So Gore joined with Gingrich in helping shape that legislation and declaring that legislation as good for the democratic media soul, when, of course, we know the opposite was true, and Gore was always has always been looking, to raise money from these very powerful interests. And, of course, Gore went in, even though I think what he's doing is admirable in terms of the environment, right after he left office, Gore, entered into the cable television business himself. In fact, it was Rupert Murdoch who made the essential deal that allowed Al Gore to become partner in this current TV channel that he operates. So I think Gore's role is extremely disappointing, and it just shows you that power politics helps obscure power media politics helps obscure what is real reality for people. It was a giveaway. It was a sellout. It did nothing to advance the cause of democratic media in the United States. It only empowered a handful. Yet Gore and others praised it as fulfilling an important function
for
democracy.
Jeff Chester, what was the nature of the press coverage? I mean, how aware were people of the Telecom Act? And then in answering that, talk about the news media coverage of communication and media policy issues in general. So that how aware can the average citizen, say, the listener to this show, be of what's going on with these internet and ownership and media policies if they're decent consumers of television news in their local newspaper?
Well, I think it is there is an analogy that is striking. I mean, during the debate of the 1996 Act, and I tried to do my best to get whatever press coverage the Public Interest Coalition was able to get. The fact of the matter is, these big media outlets did not want to cover this bill because the reporters knew that their outlet and their owners, or perhaps their future owner, had a position on the bill. So, Time Magazine didn't really want to cover it because, after all, it was Time Warner was lobbying the bill. You didn't see coverage. It was a blackout in terms of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, with rare exceptions. And when you talk to reporters, you could almost feel the fear and anxiety they had, because they frankly didn't know whether or not the person that they might end up criticizing, or the issue they might end up criticizing if they wrote about the bill, would soon end up, after the act passed, as their new owner. Now, with today, you see a lot of coverage about new media, but it's on the business pages. You don't see nothing about the politics of, for the most part, of what is going on in terms of the internet and Washington. You don't see the consequences to privacy, for example, as these newspapers cover the latest interactive media service. And because, after all of U.S. media, with rare exceptions, are part of this, are using the same data collection, privacy, interactive marketing. They have the same business model. The U.S. news media is part of this emerging digital system where it's all based on, in their own terms, the quote-unquote monetization, unquote, of our eyeballs. It's all about making sure that they can deliver personalized advertising and marketing on behalf of the most powerful and deep-pocketed brands to us, wherever we go on their outlet and wherever we go in the electronic media as well. So consequently, in a way, they have a vested interest in not really covering the politics, or not covering well what is going on within the new media industries and how it will affect us and what's wrong with what they might be doing.
I recall in 2003 when there were the numerous hearings on media ownership that you were one of the people key for getting those organized, public hearings around the country. You had the ironic event in city after city where leading newspaper editors or publishers would be on panels discussing media ownership rules with critics of relaxing those rules, yet the newspapers that they ran wouldn't be covering the story or would barely be covering it, although the editor thought it was so important to the publisher they would show up themselves.
But that raises, I think, to me, an important point, which is dovetails with why I wrote the book. We have a media system in this country in crisis, and we as a public are in crisis. It's not just that they didn't cover, the debates over the Communications Act. They did not effectively report and inform us about what was going on that led us into the war in Iraq. They have failed to really cover the disaster that went on in the Gulf region. There's been hardly any coverage of what's going on in New Orleans. Poor people in this country are totally blacked out. Women and people of color still own no major electronic media outlet. That's why I think, as we think about a kind of policy and media agenda for America at this point, we can't totally totally, we can't rely on the mainstream media. We're never going to be able to change the mainstream media because they haven't done it so far. There's no reason that they're going to do it again, that they're going to invest in the investigative reporting and really challenge the status quo. And it's doubtful, I think, that Congress is going to come in and do anything to really shake up the media to better serve the public, because this is a system that works well for them. Therefore, I think we have to, those who care about the electronic media in this country, have to think about trying to foster a kind of new generation of media outlets, both more sort of traditional journalism and sort of public interest media outlets, both in community after community and around the country, that do the job that needs to be done to make sure we are living in a place where people have access to information and where the issues of the day that sorely need to be addressed are, in fact, presented, debated, and hopefully solved.
Our guest, Jeff Chester. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Jeff Chester, author of the brand new book, Digital Destiny, New Media and the Future of Democracy, published by New Press this year, 2007. We're recording this prior to going on air, so please don't call in. Sit back, relax, let us do the talking. We're talking about Jeff's new book. Jeff, one of the subjects that comes up in the book, too, is the importance of research that we need as a society to make the sort of fundamental decisions about having a viable press system, media system, digital system in the coming years. And you single out, if I may say so, and I don't take any offense at it, academic communication scholars as being really not doing their end of the deal for the public interest. Can you talk about that?
Well, look, one of the things I try to do in the book, for those who are interested in why we have the kind of media system in this country that we have, is that the media industry is used its deep pockets, and they've done this, of course, for decades, but they've increased what they're spending. They've used their deep pockets to buy nonprofit groups, hire academics, in fact, practically hire entire universities. So these decisions are being made in Washington, in state capitals, where research from an independent perspective about what is happening, what the options are, would be very useful. But who has the money to support that research, and what kind of research gets done by these so-called prestigious academics? And of course, I wasn't referring to you, because, and I say this sincerely, that you're one of the things that has always made you stand out is that you are one of the handful of communications academics who do speak in terms of the needs of the larger public. But I feel sadly that so many communications scholars are simply bought hook, line, and sinker by these big media companies. They give them huge amounts of money. They write research that, of course, surprise, surprise, supports the corporate media lobby. And it's that a corporate-funded research and analysis that gets cited as the Federal Communications Commission, other agencies, and the Congress create rules and pass legislation. It's an utterly corrupt system. The FCC should, in fact, have the resources to support truly independent research, and frankly, universities need to do a better job in either urging their scholars to conduct independent research or raising money from charitable foundations to help fund that research. But the policies we have in the United States around communications is in large part due to the corporate-funded research by the biggest companies.
Jeff Chester, you write in the book about Michael Pollan, and you go into some detail on the 2003 media ownership fight. I've written about both Pollan and the ownership fight as well. Michael Powell, I think it's fair to say, in both our takes, doesn't come across very well as a person who's supposed to be representing the public interest. Do you think Powell's an anomaly, or was he just sort of the first one who got caught?
No, I don't think Powell was an anomaly. Of course, Powell was so egotistical. I mean, in some sense, as I say in the book, I mean, we are so lucky. We have to be grateful we had Michael Powell. Because Michael Powell was so self-absorbed, so confident in his own worldview that he was completely correct about everything. I mean, under Powell's perspective, I mean, the internet was here. We didn't have to worry anymore. And one company, in a single town could own the newspaper, several TV stations, 8 radio stations, the cable system, the internet service provider. I mean, Powell was assured that you could get rid of all the media ownership rules. And it was in that way, his kind of hubris, that alienated critics all across the board, which helped us ultimately fight him. No, I think that I don't think it's an anomaly. I think that most people who come, who are appointed to the FCC, are part of this kind of elite system, and they view what the industry does as the only kind of appropriate philosophy. They don't come in there and say, as I think they should, how can this powerful media system serve the average member of our republic? What can be done to ensure they have access to more news and more information, that there's a greater diversity of ownership and more creative expression? They don't ask themselves those questions. And now it's important, as we put people onto the FCC and as we have new people coming in to Congress on the committees overseeing communications, that we urge them to look ahead. The changes that I described going on, this emergence of this powerful digital media system, we already know a number of the characteristics. As I say, it's going to be consolidated. We're going to see more media mergers in the new media sector. Because new media is personalized and it uses techniques involving virtual reality, indeed the advertisers I talk about in my book are now doing research so they can better use digital media to actually target our unconscious minds, to work at a subconscious emotional level, to get us to buy things. When you add all this together, the fact that the most powerful companies, media companies and brands, are working together, harnessing this new media system, so wherever we go, through the mobile system, through the television system, through the PC, their content will be there to dominate. They'll be collecting all this information about us, online profiling, in order to get us to buy things, to do things. You know, we already see all these characteristics. We need people out there who can sound the alarm and say, hey, we need safeguards, but we also need an electronic media system that puts the interests of the public before the interests of these powerful corporate forces who are only concerned at the end of the day, once again, it's their word, with monetization. There's more to American democracy than making a book, making a buck. Maybe in my case, making a book
and a buck, I hope.
So that's what we need now. We need. I fear the best commissioners at the FCC now are still looking backward, Bob. They're looking at broadcasting. Well, we now live in a world. It may not be fully apparent to everybody yet, but we live in a world that the industry itself knows is anywhere, anytime, wherever you are, this content will be there. And the content may not be necessarily regulatable, if you know what I'm saying. So we really need to come up with a kind of plan and have advocates for that plan that will ensure that our digital destiny is not a sad rerun of media systems past.
In Digital Destiny, Jeff Chester, you spend a great deal of time chronicling just what you've been talking about, which is the extraordinary efforts of media firms, of advertisers, of marketers to harness the internet, to build it into their system, to sort of build their needs into the DNA of the digital system. You raise the key question. What do we do to stop it? What citizens who read this book, who listen to your interview, what's the next step? What are the sort of things people need to do if they say, I agree, Jeff Chester, the internet shouldn't be just turned over to Madison Avenue and have sort of deep-wired commercialism directly into all our brains. It should stand for something else. What are the political options? What are the alternatives, and how do we get there?
It's a good and complicated question. On the one hand, I think what we need to do is cut off the data if we can. And for those of your listeners who are interested, early in November, my organization, along with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, filed a 50-page complaint. It's available at our website, democraticmedia.org. We filed a complaint at the Federal Trade Commission that lays out all the ways they are collecting data about us and how they intend to use it. And we urge the Federal Trade Commission to either create safeguards or ask the Congress to create safeguards. So on the one hand, you know, if we have, with pressure, if we have vigilant state attorneys general, consumer advocates, with Congress, we can pass legislation that doesn't allow these companies to constantly collect information about us wherever we go, to compile, as they are doing, these online profiles that are updated literally instantaneously, and that will track us wherever we are, whether we're using our cell phones, our PCs, or TVs. We can cut off their immediate data access, although that won't be easy. You know, but at the same time, we are going to live, I fear, in a world dominated by this kind of commercialism. I am concerned, Bob, that we are coming to the realization that we have built this perfect digital marketing machine, or they have built this machine in a stealth fashion. We're coming to this argument too late. It's already there. It's the basic business model for the tens of billions of dollars, if not more, that's been spent by the largest media companies to shape our digital future. Google bought YouTube so it could deliver this kind of interactive advertising, particularly for big brands, better to the public. Murdoch bought MySpace basically to serve the needs of those advertisers and marketers. So they've built this huge system. And it's all about profits for a few, and it's all about, you know, glamorizing a lifestyle of consumption. I think the public interest community, both the policy advocates and people that are making content, need to work together so that we provide a serious alternative to the commercial status quo. And, you know, I'm trying to work this out in my own mind, to be honest with you, because I think on the one hand it's going to be a totally commercialized media world. I don't see much room for non-commercial space because, in part, the leadership at public broadcasting in this country is so incompetent and inept that they themselves don't have a vision for their own future. So if we don't have a kind of non-commercial alternative emerging, if there isn't the kind of digital commons emerging, and everything is commercial, is there a way for the public interest to be served in part, you know, by modifying that commercial system that allows them to generate some revenues but puts the needs of people and communities and their privacy first?
Well, that's a good question. But where would you urge people to go after this show if they say, okay, I'm with you, Chester. What website should they go to? What should they start paying attention to? What media should they look at? How should people stay on top of this issue or these issues and participate? Because it sounds like there's really a lot of thinking that's still got to be done. There's not a button to push.
No, there's not. And I actually think we need to have a dual strategy, Bob, which is we have to push the policy envelope in Washington at the state capitals and say, look, we want to have an open internet. We want to have more funding for community digital media. We want to make sure that the cable and the phone television network and the mobile network, you know, those are private networks. They have to be opened up too, just like we want an open internet. You know, we want to have an aggressive policy agenda, but at the same time, we can't put all our hopes that all of a sudden Congress is going to change its campaign contribution stripes and endorse a people's agenda over the special interests. So we have to try to shape the marketplace to serve public interest needs. I said, once again, I think it behooves us to do so because we can no longer rely on mainstream media to provide the public with news and information that they need to engage in everyday activities, let alone survive. I think people should go to paidcontent.org. Paidcontent.org is a Monday through Friday newsletter, but it's a website that every day tracks all the investment going into new media, and it's called the Web 2.0 by some. But if you want to see how the commercial industry is investing to define what will be the U.S.'s and much of the world's media reality in the future, go to paycontent.org, because then you'll see, as I say, day after day, all of these companies getting the venture capital, getting significant investment, that, you know, with these services out there early, so that they will have such a market advantage. And it's all based on advertising and marketing. And these are going to be very powerful forces in the lives, especially of young people who are already part of this new media world. And I think that's something we have to recognize in trying to respond to all these changes. We need to create a digital media world that young people are not only comfortable with, but want to participate in, because that's the future of then I think they need to go and they need to go to the good advocacy groups, including Free Press and Common Cause and others, to find out what's happening with public policy. And you know, there are a handful of other sites that focus on what's going on with Web 2.0 and investment as well, and people can find links to those on our site.
Jeff Chester, are there any immediate political fights right now, policy fights in Washington, that you think people should be tuned in on and participating in, the right away stuff, not down the road?
Absolutely. Look, we have to push for an open internet, which is called network neutrality, and that's going to be a hot issue at the beginning of this new Congress now. But and once again, I think what we have to think about is pushing for a serious agenda, serious media and policy agenda that would truly advance the needs in a democracy for a system that serves the public and not just a handful of special interests. Privacy is going to be a huge issue in this new Congress as well, where privacy advocates are going to try to get the safeguards that we just talked about, where you control your data and companies don't automatically collect and profile you. I think we have to push policies to make sure that all people who want high-speed internet access but can't afford it have it. We have to make the promise of equitable access a reality. You can't have 80% of the people having instant access at home or at work and 20% really left out.
Jeff, are there politicians, in the case, say, of digital privacy, are there politicians on the Hill now who are sympathetic to your position, who are leading the fight on that, or are we still not even at that point?
Well, I think you have Senator Leahy and Representative Ed Markey, who are privacy advocates. But I think, frankly, the advertising lobby is so powerful. I mean, it is like the broadcast, and telephone lobby, that I frankly doubt whether or not we're going to see serious legislation passed that will protect us.
Jeff Chester, our guest today. We've only got about a minute or so left, Jeff Chester. What do you read yourself to follow these issues, to stay on top of stuff? What's your diet?
Well, I try to read all of the new new media trade publications, and you know, in addition to paid content, there's one on mobile applications. I think people should go to imediaconnection.com. That's the letter I. iMedia Connection, Advertising Age. If you really want to know the future of U.S. media, you need to know what the marketers are doing. ClickZ, ClickZ.com. What the digital marketing industry, along with their big media partners, are doing and plan to do, fascinates me every day. It frankly horrifies me.
Jeff Chester, on that tepid note, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters. Jeff Chester, author of Digital Destiny, New Media and the Future of Democracy, just published by New Press. He's also the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy. Again, Jeff Chester, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours with yet another episode of Media Matters. Thank you very much.